At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
To taper or not to taper actually is not the question, you guys. What we need to know is when. The Fed on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 17th of December. Glad, as always, to have you with us. And we will begin today, as we do from time to time on this radio program, with the lead story from tomorrow's business pages. What the Federal Open Market Committee will choose to do about quantitative easing, its big bond buying program. It is very nearly an article of faith that the end of the Fed's economic stimulus is nigh and that all that's left is for Chairman Bernanke and the gang to tell us exactly when they will be taking away the punch bowl. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains what might happen then.
If the Fed's plan lifts the economy the way it hopes, interest rates will rise eventually. University of Wisconsin economist Ken West reminds us what that does to bond prices.
The price of the securities goes down. It means the Fed, to a certain extent, bought high. They're buying high and selling low.
Yep. It's the exact opposite of what a good investor does. Odd as it sounds, the Fed stands to lose money selling those bonds in the future. Then there's the impact on the market of the Fed's deep dive into bonds.
Fed purchases have been substantial.
Dartmouth Business School Associate Dean Matt Slaughter says you can't stop gobbling up $85 billion in bonds every month without making waves.
One of the big open questions is, from where inside the United States or abroad will creditors appear to buy that kind of debt in the future from the U.S. Treasury?
Then there's the political risk of QE. Hamilton College professor Ann Owen is a former Fed economist.
Certainly, if you're at the Federal Reserve, you would like to implement your monetary policy without taking a lot of criticism from Congress.
Even when less aggressive, the Fed has its critics. The most extreme don't even think the central bank should exist. QE really riles up lawmakers with that view, and they can make life complicated for the Fed. Brookings Institution senior fellow Justin Wolfers concedes QE's risks, but says the benefits outweigh them.
Caution always makes sense, but this is not a reason not to do it, because not doing quantitative easing also means leaving millions of people unemployed.
We'll find out the Fed's take tomorrow. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
There is big news from Big Pharma today. Drug maker GlaxoSmithKline is going to stop paying doctors worldwide for speaking engagements and going to fancy conferences. Also, it's going to stop setting targets for its drug reps, the traveling salesmen that you sometimes run into in the waiting room. The company has been testing a similar approach here since 2011, judging its salesmen on their medical and business knowledge instead of how many drugs they can sell. Marketplace's Adrian Hill takes a look at the evolving role of pharma reps in doctors' offices.
Detail men, sales reps who sell doctors on new drugs. They became a fixture in the mid-20th century when federal laws first started requiring prescriptions for some drugs. Jeremy Green is a medical historian at Johns Hopkins University.
So you have the creation of this prescription-only drug at exactly the time that the American pharmaceutical industry is transforming into innovative patent-protected medicines.
Pharma companies realized doctors' prescription pads were the funnels to drug sales.
And all of this puts an increased emphasis on not just having salesmen, but having a trained detail man, and they were almost all men in the mid-20th century, But have this trained detail man that you could put into the doctor's office.
Green says initially these detail men were nervous about teaching doctors how to do their job. That changed. Drug reps, men and women, became fixtures at doctors' offices. You know, the often attractive folks waiting purposefully in a room of sick people. These days, the job is changing again. Doctors just aren't the funnels to drug sales they once were. Ernst Berndt is a health economics professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management.
Physician autonomy over prescribing has been decreasing over time.
Benefit managers make more of the calls about what drugs you'll get. Now pharma companies have to make their case to health plans, not just doctors. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, snoozer. Everybody's waiting for the Fed tomorrow. We'll have the details when we do the number. Angela Merkel was sworn in as the Chancellor of Germany again. Today it is her third term running Europe's biggest economy. Germany is doing pretty well compared to its neighbors. Take as just one measure, youth unemployment. It sits at almost 24% across the European Union, less than 8% in Germany. So this week, our man in Europe, Stephen Beard, is surveying the state of young people without jobs across the continent for a series he's calling Jobless Generation. Today, Deutschland.
At a gym in Düsseldorf in northern Germany, a trainer puts an exercise class through its paces.
Langsam fertig werden. Und 20 Sekunden. Let's go.
Running on the spot, push-ups, step-ups, jumping and pumping iron. Among the exercisers, a young jobless Spaniard letting off steam.
It helps with the stress, of course. Good way to let it out, I think.
It does help with stress.
Yeah, of course, of course. I'm breathless, I'm sorry.
Jose Manuel Moreno is a 29-year-old Spanish doctor. The intense hour-long exercise routine is one of his ways of coping with unemployment. Among his other strategies, emigrating and learning German.
Verben mit präpositionalem Kasus. Okay, ich frage dich. Wir nehmen das Verb denken.
4.5 hours a day for 8 months here at the Goethe Institute in Düsseldorf, Jose has been getting to grips with one of Europe's most difficult languages and handling the hardships of emigration.
It's not easy. It's not a piece of cake, you know, because you're leaving a lot of things behind, especially like family and friends. But I don't regret it. Once you take the step, there's no turning back, you know.
At least in Germany, after he's learned the language, he has the certainty of a job. German hospitals urgently need at least 7,000 doctors. Back home in Spain, half of Jose's age group faces a workless future.
If you want to make a living, if you want to progress and be happy, bottom line, it's sadly going abroad.
Increasingly, for young unemployed southern Europeans, going abroad means coming here to Germany. With its low birth rate, aging population, and relatively buoyant economy, Germany needs young, skilled workers.
It's easier to find a job in Germany. It's probably the best place to find a job in engineering in Europe.
26-year-old Leonor Villa-Lobos from Portugal. She graduated as a geomatics engineer, spent a year out of work, and now she's also here at the Goethe Institute learning German.
I thought maybe I'll start searching for a job here. Of course, I prefer Portugal, but now it's almost impossible to find a job there. Or at least a good job or a job where I can be well paid.
Stefan Brunner, Goethe-Institut Düsseldorf, guten Tag.
In his office at the Düsseldorf branch of the Goethe-Institute, the affable director, Stefan Brunner, can see an upside to youth unemployment in southern Europe. The institute is teaching more German language courses than ever, and he says emigration is helping European unity.
It's really tragic what's going on in southern Europe, but at the same time I think that might be a good chance for the future. If you're trying to get people in Europe from different countries closer together.
But the young southern Europeans making the move and trying to mingle with their northern counterparts have mixed feelings. Jose Manuel Moreno is grateful to Germany, But how does he feel about his native Spain?
I feel betrayed. I feel like there are no opportunities. There's nothing for us back in Spain. So, yeah, I feel betrayed. So does my friends. So does my generation.
And 24-year-old Stamatia Constanta, a qualified dietitian from Greece, misses the warmth of home, while determined to find work in this cooler northern climate.
Do you see yourself living all your life here?
No, I don't think so. I don't want to live all my life here. They're not happy.
They're not happy? You think they're miserable?
Maybe the weather.
Tomorrow, I'm heading south to sunny Spain, where, in spite of horrendous levels of unemployment, many young people cannot bear to tear themselves away from home. In Dusseldorf, Germany, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Jobs for pretty much any age group aren't all that much of a problem in North Dakota. Tens of thousands of people have flooded the small towns out there to work in the oil fields. Independent producer Todd Melby has a series he's been working on. It's called Black Gold Boom, about the oil field economy and the jobs that it creates.
My name is Elsie Ejizimiku. Home is in South Carolina, but I came from Illinois to here. I'm a truck driver / cab driver. I drive trucks during the day, I do water and septic, and then I do cab driving at night. I love it. The work is good, we're busy, you make good money. I went through a divorce and had a 5-bedroom home that we had to sell, and the market was so low on it and stuff, and you know, I just wanted a fresh start, so I came to North Dakota. At this time in my life, and kind of like I'm starting over after being married for 25 years, it's like, this is the perfect opportunity for me because I get to work and, you know, I get to still spend time with my kids. Like, I went home, I didn't even think twice about buying a ticket for $900. I mean, the moment we set foot in Fargo, you know, people were offering us jobs. We went to the Walmart to get something for the camper. They was like, you know, you need a job. You know, we're hiring. I was like, well, we heard there's a Walmart Williston that's paying, you know, you don't need to go to Williston. We have easier housing here. You know, it was just fun. It's just like I've never seen this. You know, I've never seen where everywhere there's a job.
Todd's series, Black Gold Boom, is an initiative of Prairie Public Broadcasting and the Association of Independents in Radio. Coming up, it's shiny, it's expensive, and it's boring.
The interesting thing about gold is chemically how uninteresting it is. This is an element that barely reacts with any other element.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 9 points today, less than 0.1% for the blue chips, ended at 15,875. The NASDAQ off 5 points, 0.1%, 4,023. The S&P 500 down 5 points, 0.3%, closed at 1781. Facebook is offering its advertisers a new service, video ads that start playing as soon as you open your Facebook feed. Facebook shares were fed a 2% gain as a result. Corporations are lining up to give more of their profits to shareholders rather than invest. In the last couple of days, AT&T, General Electric, Archer Daniels Midland. The latest is Boeing, which increased its dividend by half and will spend $10 billion to buy back shares. Boeing shares up 0.8% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-notes down to 2.84%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace, so please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. FedEx delivers quarterly earnings. Speaking of deliveries, the U.S. Postal Service expects tomorrow will be its busiest delivery day for mail. Oh, geez, I feel so behind on my holiday cards. And 'tis the season for sugar plum fairies and tutus. Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker premiered in St. Petersburg on December 18th, 1892. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. When you recharge your cell phone or turn on your computer or plug in your coffee maker, where does that power come from? 10 years ago, about 51% of all the electricity in this country came from coal. This year, that number is something near 37%. Cheaper natural gas and stricter emissions rules have conspired against King Coal in this country, which is why the coal industry is looking for new markets. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Sarah Gardner went in search.
That's what 120 tons of coal sounds like when you dump it into a railroad car. Not far from the place where Sitting Bull defeated Custer, Cloud Peak Energy is mining coal and transporting it by rail. This batch, it's headed to power plants in the Midwest. To get here, you drive miles of rural highway without seeing another car. You'd miss the sign that says Spring Creek Mine if you weren't really looking for it. The one under it warns no trespassing. But this year, Cloud Peak has welcomed a slew of visitors, an unusual move in an industry wary of too much exposure.
Just watch the handrails going up.
All right. There are no pickaxes, no grimy-faced miners choking on coal dust here. These western strip mines are like a four-year-old's Tonka truck fantasy.
10-4, yeah, you're right on that fault line, Ed.
Workers here operate some of the biggest, priciest, heaviest machines in the world. Excavators tear into blasted topsoil and rock to uncover the coal below. Cloud Peak's home office, 2 hours away, tracks every move these machines make using onboard computers and GPS. Darren White, a former airline technician, is the mine's production planner.
We're standing here in Pit 3. We're actually looking at this 301 shovel, which is a 2300 shovel. It's loading our 240-ton haul trucks. It's like driving your house on wheels. It's that big.
Spring Creek is just one of a dozen or so mines in the Powder River Basin. Together, they supply 40% of the nation's coal. A chunk of this coal, well, it doesn't generate as much energy as Appalachia's, but it's cheaper and cleaner for the most part. Thanks to the Clean Air Act, this low-sulfur coal found a market. But with a wave of old coal plants set to retire or switch to natural gas here at home, Cloud Peak and other coal companies in Montana and Wyoming are searching for other markets for their product, and they're counting on Asia, where the demand for coal is still rising. Cloud Peak's Rick Kurtzinger.
Certainly the world, its electricity demand is increasing. Asia is projected to double its energy use over the next two decades. A significant amount of that will come from coal.
Cloud Peak and other producers here already do a fledgling export business with Asia, shipping through ports in Canada. But to dramatically grow that business, the industry needs more sprawling export terminals in the Pacific Northwest, more mile-long coal trains rumbling across Montana, Oregon, and Washington. Teresa Erickson has been fighting coal for over a quarter of a century.
Once the railroad companies and the U.S. government invests in these massive infrastructures to accommodate exporting massive amounts of coal, then we're addicted. Then we will justify for decades why we must continue to export coal, and it will delay the very necessary move of becoming a renewable energy country.
Erickson heads the Northern Plains Resource Council in Billings. It's an odd alliance of environmentalists and ranchers who've been fighting coal since the 70s, actually. That's when East Coast coal companies first tried to mine in Montana. Third-generation rancher Steve Charter was a teenager then.
They kind of came in with what we thought was kind of a bad attitude, is they're pretty well used to running over the people in Appalachia and, you know, figured these are pretty rural, kind of backcountry people, and ranchers, their land is their identity. So if you know, you come to push somebody off their land, it's getting pretty personal.
But it wasn't until the last few years that coal got personal for a whole bunch of people. The industry's current bid to export coal to Asia attracted unwanted attention to the mines here, and it's galvanized groups all over the country, from the Sierra Club to Northwest Native Tribes. Even Catholic bishops in the state of Washington are chiming in, worried about coal dust, train traffic, treaty rights, and global warming. Erickson says for years her group's fight against coal mining here went virtually unnoticed.
Because, you know, you don't really see strip mines. You don't drive by strip mines. They're hidden. And so our fight was quite a lonely fight. And suddenly it's a global fight now. And the globe is on our side.
Certainly right now, the industry's export dreams look starry-eyed. Global coal prices have fallen dramatically from their highs 2 years ago. Investors have dropped plans for 3 of 6 coal terminals in the Northwest, and the rest face fierce and organized opposition. The market's so soft that this past summer, nobody bid on a federal coal tract up for lease in Wyoming, a first for the region. But the industry is betting global coal prices will eventually recover. And even with the EPA and cheap natural gas biting into sales, Cloud Peak's Kurtzinger insists it's hardly game over here at home.
So when you hear people talk about the end of coal, what do you think?
The Energy Information Administration has projected that coal is going to remain the single largest source of U.S. electricity through at least 2040. We believe that coal will continue to be an important part of the U.S.'s energy mix well into the future.
The latest government forecast actually puts natural gas ahead of coal by 2040, but coal might still supply nearly a third of America's power when today's babies are starting their careers, some of them perhaps commuting to work in electric cars fueled by coal. In the Powder River Basin, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We've got some pictures from the coal operations that Sarah was looking at on our website. And while you're there, you can also find out if your electricity comes from coal. It's all at marketplace.org. Coming up tomorrow, our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz on whether China really wants our coal or not. The latest thing for big technology companies isn't merely to dominate their particular corner of the web. Search for Google, social for Facebook, you get the idea. They also want to own the pipes that bring the internet to you. Google has been laying cables in the oceans around Asia. Facebook has bought fiber to move traffic back and forth from its data centers. The problem is that hardware access to the internet is still largely controlled by old line telecommunications companies. Marketplace's Queenie Kim explains.
Alan Hammond is the director of the Broadband Institute at Santa Clara University. And when I asked him, why do the tech giants want control of how the internet is delivered? He launched into a fairy tale of the three billy goats gruff.
There were three billy goats gruff who wanted to cross the bridge to eat the green grass on the other side.
The first goat tries to cross, but the troll living under the bridge tells him to get off.
In this case, the troll under the bridge is the telcos.
Or telecom companies. The bridge is the internet pipeline that they control. And the goats are tech companies like Google, Netflix, and Amazon who need that bridge to deliver their content. In the fairy tale, the goats get rid of the troll. But in real life, Hammond says,
instead of getting rid of the troll, they'll build their own bridge.
Hammond says companies like Verizon have made it clear they want to start charging tech giants for distributing data-heavy content like video. Dan Beeler is a telecom analyst at Forrester. He says it's not just video that the tech giants are worried about. As our lives move on to the cloud, tech companies need an ever bigger pipeline.
So if you upload a document on Dropbox, if you're using Google Apps, so documents that are cloud-based.
Beeler says there's also the apps on your smartphone, your Fitbits, and more companies are ditching their servers and renting space on Amazon, Google, and Microsoft's cloud. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Our every now and then contributor Justin Rowlett from the BBC has been working on a series about new ways to look at the global economy. Through a microscope, in a manner of speaking, elementary business, he calls it, the chemical elements and how they make the world's economy go round. Today, atomic number 79, the symbol is AU. Hey, Justin.
Hi, Kai.
Gold, my friend. It's in them thar hills.
No, at
right?
Last, we've come to the most charismatic of all the elements, haven't we?
I suppose.
But the interesting thing about gold, Kai, is chemically how uninteresting it is. This is an element that barely reacts with any other element.
Yeah, well, how did it become, as opposed to, I don't know, lead or iron? Why is gold the thing that it has become?
Well, that was the question that we asked, and we kind of got a copy of the periodic table and
you know, systematically excluded elements. And it's quite easy when you start to think about it to see why, of the 118 elements there are in the periodic table, why many of them just simply would never be suitable for currency. So, for example, a gaseous currency is never going to be that good, is it? I mean, carrying around little files of colourless gas is going to be pretty hard to establish what you've got. Then you've got all these reactive elements, you know, the really reactive elements. You don't want an explosive currency. And again, you brought up lead and iron. Well, both of those do, they're not as reactive as potassium, but both of them do corrode in moist air. So it turns out that the fact that gold is so uninteresting is one of the reasons why it's so useful. You know, you can cast a gold coin and it'll stay almost exactly the same kind of for eternity.
But didn't I read, and it might have actually been in your piece, that all the world's gold ever that was mined in the history of people fits into a cube 20-something meters on a side, right?
20 meters by 20 meters. It's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, every bit of gold ever mined in history. And because gold is so precious, we tend to recycle it.
We have in the bowels of the Federal Reserve Building in New York City, deep in the Manhattan bedrock, huge piles of gold bullion. I'm sure the Bank of England has its piles, right? It used to be...
We sold a lot of gold, actually. Yeah. Our previous prime minister sold the gold, actually, at the bottom of the gold market.
Nice.
Sold off a huge
Nicely
amount.
Done.
Because obviously, we, like America, we used to have a gold standard currency as well. We used to have a currency pegged to gold.
But, you know, every now and then you get people, especially here in this country, Ron Paul, in the last presidential election, wants to take us back to the gold standard. It comes up every now and then.
I think psychologically, we like the idea that, you know, in exchange for the notes in our wallet, we might get something in return rather than more paper. But actually, in economic terms, it means you're bound into a much less flexible economic system. You know, you're dependent on those reserves of gold. And actually, historically, these fiat currencies, since 73, when Nixon decoupled America from the gold standard, these fiat currencies have performed very well and arguably better than gold. They're much more stable.
Right. You look at gold now, and it was $1,250 an ounce, you know, a couple of weeks ago, but it's been as low as a couple of hundred bucks not too long ago.
Yeah. 2001, it was $260 a troy ounce. It peaked at $1,921 a troy ounce in September 2011. So, I mean, a huge kind of range of value. You wouldn't really want a currency that exhibited that kind of range of value, would it?
No.
And it actually makes a non-gold standard currency seem, you know, rather more convincing when you look at the performance of the dollar over the same period.
We should do bitcoins next.
Bitcoins is a great story.
Justin Rowland from the BBC.
Cheers, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which we learn that skinny jeans almost doomed the American dollar. From the pages of the Washington Post, this historical tidbit, and remember, I was a history major. Cranes, the company that for more than a century has supplied the cotton fibers from which greenbacks are made, used to use discarded denim for its cotton. Until back in the 90s, the fashion world discovered spandex, Lycra, and how it helped jeans fit just right. And that, sadly, spoiled denim as a currency source forevermore, because you can't have stretchy dollars now, can you? So cranes just go straight to cotton plants now. All right, anyway, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 9 points. That is less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 5 points, a 10%. The S&P 500 also off 5 points, 0.3%. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I am Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.